The Texans at the Steelers. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 45. Game overview. The Steelers can attack however they want to attack in this spot. The Texans are in a difficult spot again this week regardless of how they try to attack. The ceiling on this game is relatively capped. The Steelers are the more attractive team here, with a couple of pieces I'll be keeping in mind as I work toward my narrower core. How Pittsburgh will try to win. The Texans have been pushed around on the ground so far, with the Chiefs and Ravens piling up an average of 198 rushing yards per game in this matchup, putting the Texans at 31st in the league and leaving Houston 30th in adjusted line yards in the early going. The Steelers are expected to return stud right guard David DeCastro this week, which will add to the formidability of their own offensive line slash rushing attack. Though the Texans are also attackable in the secondary, and only two teams have thrown the ball at a higher rate than the Steelers so far this year when the score is within 7 points. Any way you cut it, this is a good matchup for Pittsburgh. Sure, the Texans have faced two of the best offenses in football so far, but those won't be the last two teams to score 30-plus in this spot. Look for Pittsburgh to run a fairly balanced offense here, one that breaks toward the pass if breaking anywhere, with most of the touches for Pittsburgh concentrated on James Conner, 50 out of 65 snaps last week, 18 touches, Juju Smith-Schuster, 14 targets so far, and Deontay Johnson, 23 targets so far, with James Washington, 8 targets, Chase Claypool, 5 targets, and Eric Ebron, 7 targets, mixed in. How Houston will try to win. As we explore seemingly every week in this spot, Bill O'Brien really isn't sure what he's doing. It's easy to look at the collection of talent on this offense and feel that they should be able to scorch the scoreboard, but there's a big difference between collecting talent and actually deploying that talent in a way that makes sense. O'Brien has long been an "our talent will be your talent" coach, and the talent he has on hand at the moment is all pretty one-dimensional, which makes it easy for a good defense, Kansas City, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, to make life difficult on them. In their two games so far, the Texans have entered the fourth quarter down 17 and 13 points, and unless they are able to keep the Steelers' offense in check or pick up some short field off turnovers, they should again be chasing points in this spot. Look for the Texans to mix short passes with occasional downfield looks. Of the 66 pass attempts Deshaun Watson has so far, a stunning 30 have come within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, with 13 at or behind the line of scrimmage. And to run a washed-up David Johnson up the middle against a Steelers defense that has stonewalled the Giants and Broncos so far. Likeliest game flow. All but 6 of Patrick Mahomes' throws against the Texans came within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage in Week 1, while all but 6 of Lamar Jackson's throws came within 11 yards of the line of scrimmage, which gives us a good sense of what opposing offensive coordinators are seeing against the Texans. Each quarterback, of course, was wildly successful on these shorter throws, with Lamar throwing only 2 incompletions and notching a touchdown, while Mahomes went 21 of 26 on these shorter throws with 3 touchdowns. As we explored in this space in the past, Steelers OC Randy Fitchner is matchup adaptable in the way he attacks through the air, but this is a good spot for the Steelers to continue their heavy reliance on short passes. Juju has an ADOT of only 4.5, while Deontay has captured a large 34.9% of the Steelers' available air yards so far at an ADOT of only 7.2. Barring early mistakes or flunky plays, Pittsburgh should be in the driver's seat for this game, and while they'll take a couple downfield shots, and while Deontay and Juju each have a yak upside, it's likelier than not that they play slow and steady here. Gradually expanding and are protecting their lead as Houston naturally ends up with more stalled drives than Pittsburgh runs into. This could leave the Steelers comfortable taking field goals down the stretch to protect and extend a lead, and could dampen the overall scoring ceiling on this point. Vegas has this game at 45.0, and while it can certainly reach or exceed that number, we're looking at a tight range around the mark in most scenarios here. Only one of the Steelers' last 10 games has gone over 42, and that was 47 last week. This team has more scoring upside than last year's non-Ben team, but as a whole, it should still produce lower total games. DFS Plus interpretation. Because of how central he is to scoring on the Texans' side of the ball should always start with Watson, and Watson having a difficult time adjusting to the poorly conceived weaponry Bill O'Brien has given him, and now taking on a Steelers defense that allowed the fewest fantasy points per game to quarterbacks a year ago, he's simply a bet-on-talent play in this spot, making his weapons even more thin from there. I've had a rule the last couple years of simply don't play offensive pieces against the Steelers. The chances of a dud are always higher than you want, and the good scores that do hit against the Steelers are rarely going to be good enough to make up for the risk. But if you do want to go here, I would also add a rule of only play other Texans pieces if also playing Watson. Play your Texans pass catchers alongside him, good luck, and play David Johnson only as a hedge off of Watson exposure. The Steelers have a much softer matchup, as only the Lions and Bengals have given up more rushing yards to running backs than the Texans. And nothing in the Texans' secondary points to this defense holding up against the short area attack of the Steelers. The pieces that stand out here are James Conner and Deontay Johnson. Outside of his 59-yarder late last week, Conner rushed for only 47 yards on 15 carries, and he saw only two targets, six targets on the season. But he falls into the bucket of high-usage running back in a good matchup with a solid scoring ceiling, likely to go completely overlooked. In a vacuum, he doesn't stand out, and he's certainly no Aaron Jones play, as his raw ceiling is far lower. But he's in consideration as a strategy piece. As for Deontay, he's nice leverage off the higher price tag and higher name value of Juju, who again has so far seen his average target within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, right down at the bottom of the league. As noted seemingly everywhere on site this year, I like Deontay a lot as a wide receiver. His price tag is going to keep climbing, so if you jump on board this week and he lands on the lower end of his range, I would look at this as simply another chance to get him at a still depressed price tag down the road. He has a bit of broad range, as his short area role and heavy targets give him a high floor while cutting off some of his paths to the ceiling. But his yak upside and occasional downfield role give him enough upside to make him a potential tourney winner if everything comes together. If betting heavily on these wideouts, I could see hedging a bit with Ebron as a potential touchdown vulture. Big Ben could trip into a 3-touchdown game or a 300-yard 3-touchdown game, but his likeliest path to a tourney-winning day is for this game to turn into a shootout. So Ben rosters would optimally be brought back with one or two of the speed pieces from the Texans in order to capture the likeliest path to all-around upside there. The Bengals at the Eagles kick off Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 46.5. Game overview. Look for Philly to attack in this spot. They won't be trying to win this game by outlasting the Bengals. They'll be looking to win by scoring as many points as they can. The Bengals have trusted Burrow so far with heavy pass play rate on first downs when the score is within 7 points, and this matchup should keep the Bengals leaning on the pass. Each team should be able to put up points here, while this game should remain relatively close. Lower scoring tributaries exist, but they aren't roster cratering tributaries. I like several Eagles in this spot, and I won't mind bringing back Eagles rosters with one or two pieces from the Bengals. How Philadelphia will try to win. The Eagles and Chargers have continued to have the worst injury luck in football, though when one of your team doctors is puncturing your quarterback's lung by accident, is that bad luck or just bad care? Maybe the Chargers' issues run deeper. And this Philly offense will be condensed down to tight ends DeSean Jackson and Miles Sanders this week after Jalen Reagor was placed in IR. Greg Ward, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, and John Hightower will all mix in as well, though Ward is merely a hope-for-volume dart, while the other two are hope-they-do-something-on-a-couple-targets or hope-something-crazy-happens plays. We don't yet have a clear sense of how the Eagles will handle run-pass distribution this year, as they've been trailing in both of their games down the stretch. But Philly does lead the NFL in pass play rate this year, both with a lead of 7 or fewer points and on first downs with a lead of 7 or fewer points. These are indicators that Philly will continue to lean on Carson Wentz, 42.5 pass attempts per game so far, for as long as this game remains competitive. This creates a fun setup for DFS, more on this below of course, as we have a pass-heavy team in a good matchup, Cincy ranked bottom third of the league in adjusted sack rate last year, and they rank bottom half so far this year. Their secondary additions are injured, and their defensive line is injury depleted, with a narrow distribution of touches. Look for Philly to attack in this spot. They won't be trying to win this game by outlasting the Bengals. They'll be looking to win by scoring as many points as they can. How Cincinnati will try to win. The Bengals ranked 15th in pass play rate when the score is within 7 points, but the deeper story here is that they rank 5th in pass play rate on first down when the score is within 7 points. Zach Taylor has been aggressive in allowing Joe Burrow to put this team in position for first downs, including calling on him to throw 61 times in a Week 2 shootout with the Browns. Every team in the NFL except the Rams in Week 2 leans more pass-heavy than normal against Philly, and if you believe that this is the best spot so far for the Eagles' aggressive passing attack, i.e., Even if the speed of D-Jax doesn't lead to big plays for him, it will open intermediate looks and big play potential for the tight ends, or will open holes underneath for Sanders. To put that another way, we don't need to be concerned just yet with how the Eagles will put together consistently successful drives, but we can acknowledge that they'll have a strong shot at doing so. Then, you should believe that the Bengals are passing in this spot. 40-plus dropbacks for Burrow should be our clear expectation here, with this work primarily flowing to A.J. Green. 22 targets, 22.7%. Tyler Boyd, 13 targets at 13.4%. T. Higgins, 6 targets last week, 8.9% in that game. John Ross, 7 targets at 7.2%. And Drew Sample, 9 targets last week on top of the 11 targets C.J. Uzma has seen throughout 2 weeks before going down. 20 combined targets for these two is 20.6. On the ground, Joe Mixon will be involved. A fair projection is 15 to 18 carries, though that's a tight range without many clear paths to going far above. And through the air, Mixon, 6 targets so far, will depressingly share the load with Giovanni Bernard, 12 targets so far. Likeliest game flow. Starting this week, you can find Corey's betting slant on a few key games in the NFL edge, i.e., games where he's seeing a bet he really likes. I mention that here because Corey and I were discussing this game the other day, and I sort of worked through my thought process on this one in real time as I messaged him back on Discord. What's the likeliest game flow? We try to tighten up as much of the NFL edge as we can, and it's a long enough read as is. But this was a bit of a fun one, so I wanted to go behind the scenes for you here. Here's the likeliest game flow and how I'm seeing this game. How I worked through this game in real time. The Eagles have a solid defense with some holes and inconsistency, and Zach Taylor is a good offensive coordinator, while Burrow has solid traits. But he probably throws a pick or has a fumble, which steals a drive right there, and then a mistake or two, or a drive where something just falls apart by a few inches because this team just isn't quite a good team. But then, on the flip side, the Eagles don't often hold teams to super low scores, and the Bengals are always able to put up some points, they have some weapons, etc. So if standard range is 3-6 scoring drives in a game, I'll put them in the 4-5 score range. The Eagles are going to attack downfield, and the Bengals are not good enough to deal with the speed of D-Jax deep and the holes this opens in the intermediate and underneath areas for the tight ends and Miles Sanders without a pass rush, and they'll be inconsistent there at best. But of course, the Bengals aren't a pushover, and they try to force short throws and make the opponent work for it. And the Eagles haven't looked great. 4-5 scores is the range for them as well, but they're closer to making it 5-6. The Bengals are less likely to be successful in the red zone with a young coach and QB and in a mismatched O-line, so give them a 4-score range of 20-24 and a likely 5-score ceiling of 27. Give the Eagles a 4-score range of 20-28 and a likely 5-score ceiling of 31. So Bengals 20-27 and Eagles 20-31, but I'd lean towards 24-31 for Philly. That gives a final range for the total of 44-58, so I would peg the over-under in the middle, or 51. I would then adjust down at least a point and a half to account for the near certainty of a missed kick somewhere along the way here, and I would potentially edge down a point lower as we're not used to seeing either of these teams in truly high total games. So then 48.5 is where I would set the line myself, and I would then check to see the line. 46.5, which to me indicates more of what I realized myself after going through all that, that we're just not used to seeing these teams in high total games. But even adjusting down for a field goal heavy from Cincy, or having to try for touchdowns toward the end because they're too far behind to try field goals, and missing out on points this way, it's tough to see them going below 16 points, a touchdown and 3 field goals. And even most of the scenarios that would lead to this would have the Eagles scoring 27. So a total of 43 is low end of the reasonable likely range to me, and my original projection landed at 51. So even tightening up that line to 47.5 or 48, I'm still taking the over, and enough signs point to this that I'd call it something we'd see happen 60-plus times out of 100. Tributaries. I hit on a couple of tributaries in that thought stream above. Bengals ending up field goal heavy, or even the Eagles ending up field goal heavy, or the Eagles having a big enough lead toward the end of the game that Cincy is passing up field goals for touchdowns, which can increase scoring but can also instead kill off a game quickly. If the chasing team fails on these attempts, the team in the lead is further incentivized to bleed clock, as the clock becomes the only real friend the chasing team has left. This cuts off scoring paths for the team in the lead, and it cuts out time for the chasing team, forcing them to again go touchdown or nothing on their remaining drives. But given the narrow distribution of touches on the Eagles and the expectedly low price tags across the board, Even the bad tributaries here don't point to a dud, while the upside is higher than the Vegas line indicates. Lower scoring tributaries exist, but they aren't roster cratering tributaries that could truly detract from the upside. DFS Plus interpretation. I like this game more than I would have expected at first glance. I guess that isn't surprising. Philly has clear paths to points as an aggressive, pass-first offense that is designed to attack downfield against a well-coached but talent-strained defense. If Djax hits, he can hit big. If Djax fails to hit, he still has a high enough floor as the actual legitimate wide receiver one in this attack. His risk is lower than where we typically peg it, as he is typically a wide receiver two whose targets can sometimes drop to the 2-4 range, or whose targets can leave him empty-handed if the downfield shots aren't connecting. But last week against the Rams team that had already forced the Cowboys to work short, Philly tightened up Djax's route tree, giving him one target 20 yards downfield, 5 targets 10 yards downfield, 2 targets 5 yards downfield, and 1 target at the line of scrimmage. And if this guaranteed downfield shots connect, his upside can be slate-breaking. If Djax fails in this spot, it's unlikely that the offense as a whole misses, and it's unlikely that one of the ancillary wide receivers pops off for huge usage. This would leave Zach Ertz and Dallas Goedert in the short and intermediate areas with a clear shot at production. Both Goddard and Ertz have variable route trees, and both set up well in this spot. We think of them as short area guys, and I have driven the bandwagon for 2 years on the idea of don't roster Ertz unless you're betting on heavy volume as he's a short area piece. But as I've also noted this year, the goal for Philly is to attack with these guys at the intermediate level when their healthy speed can open up the field. But I will note that Goddard is used more frequently on seam routes and out routes, while Ertz is used more frequently on zone-beating drag routes and cross routes. I also like Miles Sanders, duh, as he played 77.8% of snaps last week. That sort of range is above standard backfield leaders like Kenyon Drake, Joe Mixon, etc., generally around 65% to 70%, and below true workhorses like Ezekiel Elliott and the injured Christian McCaffrey and Saquon Barkley, typically anywhere from 88% to 97%. He had 20 carries and 7 targets. As I noted last week, when I had him on 14 of 26 rosters, he'll be priced a tier higher in a couple of weeks than where he's priced right now. Probably around 7,200 on DK and about 7,900 on FanDuel. If I'm correct on that, that would be a 12.5% jump on DK versus a 6.8% jump on FanDuel. So the value you're getting on DK is higher, but he's a solid play either way. On the Bengals side, the chances of things not quite going well are higher, so these pieces I'm likelier to lean on in Eagles-focused rosters than elsewhere in my roster block, but I'll definitely grab some bet-on-this-game exposure to the Cincy side this week. The guy who stands out most is AJ Green, as he's a major regression candidate at the moment. He has caught only 36.4% of passes thrown his way, but he is working with an ADOT of 15.9, which would finish around 3rd or 4th in the league most years. And he has soaked up a massive 43.41% of the Bengals' available air yards. This ranks 5th in the NFL right now, and would rank top 2 or 3 in most seasons. Behind Green, Sample is interesting for what should be 5 to 8 targets, while Boyd is a bet-on-touchdowns option. Higgins is a hope-the-workload-remains-and-hope-it-comes-together-this-week play, and Ross is a hope-to-get-lucky dart. Mixon is also in play in a game environment that could play out well, though this matchup against a tough Philly run defense makes him a more boom-bust than a high-floor, high-ceiling. The 49ers at the Giants kick off Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 41.5. Game overview. The 49ers are especially banged up and may slow down this game a bit as they continue to lean run heavy. The Giants are banged up as well, and they are likely to lean on the pass to try to win this game. This isn't a great spot on the surface for scoring, but there are a few different ways this game could break. Nothing jumps off the page in DFS here, but this game can still be mined in a few different ways. How San Francisco will try to win. Against the new-look Giants defense under Patrick Graham, the short-area passing attack of the Steelers threw the ball only 32 times and racked up only 229 passing yards, while the short-area passing attack of the Bears threw the ball only 28 times for 190 yards. Jimmy Garoppolo has a shot at playing, as does George Kittle, but it's likely we see Nick Mullins out there instead, and Kittle is no sure thing. With Deebo Samuel still out, expect the 49ers, 30 pass attempts per game so far, to continue as one of the more run-heavy teams. Of course, The backfield distribution of touches is its own little mess to deal with in the interpretation segment. But insofar as how San Francisco will chase down a victory, their standard run-heavy short-passing ways should continue in this spot, with the 49ers perhaps slowing down the pace a bit from there. They ranked 20th in situation-neutral pace a year ago, but 29th overall, as they often slowed down games with a lead. This same proactive football intelligence could see Shanahan deciding that a shortened game gives his team the better chance at a win, as the more talented team, but with the enhanced risk of a backup quarterback under center and several injured pieces on defense, a shorter game means fewer opportunities for crazy things to happen. How the Giants will try to win. First off, let's say this. The Giants are going to try to win this game. I mean, of course they will, right? But when a team like the Giants loses its marquee player and is then taking on a team that has nearly won the Super Bowl, it's easy to write them off as a clear dumpster fire. But the line in this game opened at 49ers -6.5, and it has moved to 49ers -4.0. Furthermore, that's not a bet I would be comfortable taking. Not that I think the Giants have some sort of clear edge here, but it's a true 50-50 shot that this team could finish with a loss of 3 or fewer points, and it's very easy to swing over to a Giants win with a couple of big things breaking their way from there. So let's give this team a bit of respect, recognizing that even if it's easy to write them off on the surface, they'll be coming out hunting for a win against a backup quarterback and a banged-up defense. The Giants rank 4th in the NFL in pass play rate to begin the year, and they are down their top running back with Saquon Barkley out of the action, which should push them more completely to the air. We'll get to the way touches should be distributed on this offense in the interpretation segment, but expect a short area attack that mixes in a few downfield looks to Darius Slayton, with a backfield rotation that keeps Deion Lewis and Wayne Gallman at the top this week as Devontae Freeman gets his feet under him in New York. Likeliest game flow. This game is interesting. The 49ers can still get downhill on the Giants, but the relative strength of the Giants is their run-stuffing line. The Giants don't have a pass rush, but they ranked 7th in adjusted line yards last season. The Giants gave up 4.47 yards per carry to running backs last season, but this number was influenced by issues at the second level that led to a high number of 20-plus yard rushes, including a number of rushes much longer than that. As such, this could be a game of short game on the ground, short gain on the ground, try to convert on third, short gain through the air, short gain on the ground, try to convert on third, etc. Without the violent downhill speed of Mostert and without Jimmy G, the 49ers could require a handful of big plays to hit in order for this game to take off. On the other side of the ball, Daniel Jones will face a 49ers pass rush that is suddenly a question mark, with Eric Armstead working without the help of Nick Bosa. And while the 49ers will still have the solid presence of Kawan Williams in the slot and the solid presence of Emmanuel Mosley on one side of the field, the dominating presence of Richard Sherman is missing on the other side, where the Giants will be able to attack Ekello Witherspoon. Diving another layer deeper in the individual matchups, OWS favorite Fred Warner creates a tough pass game matchup for the Giants running backs, while Evan Ingram will deal with a number of matchups, none of which are easy, but none of which should give him much trouble. Put it all together, and with the 49ers still presenting a challenge against the run, the Giants' best path is to lean on Evan Ingram in the short areas of the field, with plenty of Golden Tate mixed in, while moving Darius Slayton around for favorable matchups and targeting him on intermediate and downfield looks. In the same way that the 49ers' likeliest approach could lead to a number of eventually stalled drives, the Giants could easily run into enough negative plays for this game to disappoint. With all that said, there are other ways for this game to play out. The 49ers could hit some big plays on the ground or after the catch, and Daniel Jones could create some magic with big plays to Slayton and targets piling up for Ingram. I'm having a difficult time pinning down a line on this game, but wherever Vegas has it, just checked, it's sitting at 41.5, there's a decently broad range on either side in which the scoring in this game could fall. DFS Plus interpretation. With both of these teams carrying a Vegas-implied total of 23 or below, and with the injuries likely drawing some DFS attention, DFS players love spots where a player is filling in due to injury, there is nothing in this game that jumps off the page to me. To say that another way, if this game were going entirely overlooked, there might be some sneaky plays. But if the public is poking around here, it becomes more plus EV to just leave this alone. There are some likely landmines, and the chances of missing out on a have-to-have-it score are low. With that said, the Giants are not a scary secondary, so if you want to bet on the possession plus end zone role of Kendrick Byrne, 5 targets each game so far, the yak role of Brandon Ayuk, only 3 targets last week but a healthy 44 snaps, or 49ers tight end, you can certainly make a case. RE tight ends. If it's Kittle, Sonic pulled up these stats this week from RotoViz. With Mullins, Kittle averages 2.4 more targets, 0.9 more receptions, 0.08 more touchdowns, 26.03 more yards, and 3.83 more PPR points per game than he averages without Mullins. As always, Kittle has to really hit in order to justify his price tag, but especially on FanDuel, where it's more about production than price tag anyway, he would be viable, while the upside is there on DraftKings. If it's instead Jordan Reed, well, my caution on him last week was that he had only played 10 snaps in Week 1, and I expected the 49ers to keep him in the 20 to 25 snap range last week. I was right about this. Reed played only 28 snaps, but he saw 8 targets on those snaps and scored 2 touchdowns. A 5-for-40-0 line is likelier than another 7-for-50-2, but it wouldn't be surprising if he saw around 30 snaps again this week, and the 49ers are happy to throw to him when he's out there. In the backfield, the big question for me is how willing the 49ers are to give McKinnon a heavy share of snaps. Jeff Wilson is the likeliest back to see 15-plus touches, but against a run defense that is more short gain, short gain, short gain, long gain, Wilson could easily become mostly short gains, with his long gains not doing enough to pay off. He's a bet on workload and touchdowns play, on a team where workload can be assumed, but is never 100% certain. Wilson had a game a couple of years ago with 9 targets from Mullins, but that was in a blowout loss to Seattle. Outside of that spot, he's never topped 100 yards from scrimmage. He's topped 50 yards only once, and he's never topped 2 receptions. Splitting work with Wilson will be McKinnon and UDFA Jamichael Hasty. After not playing in 2 years, McKinnon has been held to 19 snaps and 13 snaps, so while he has the most obvious appeal of the group, it's difficult to bank on a heavy workload. He's a bet-on-efficiency play. Hasty is a player the 49ers like, and if Wilson struggles early, it wouldn't be surprising to see Hasty rack up 12-plus touches. He's a large field dart with enough sneaky upside to justify the risk. On the Giants' side, it isn't yet clear if Devontae Freeman will be active here, but Freeman looked washed last year in Atlanta and had to wait until Week 3 to find a team that would give him a chance to actually play. The Giants also have Deion Lewis as their pass-catching back and Wayne Gallman as a steady fill-in they've leaned on in the past. None of these guys set up well here, so it's a hope-to-guess-right-on-some-receptions or a touchdown sort of spot. The Giants' passing attack is more interesting, with the likely pass-leaning nature of this defense and the condensed target tree in this spot. Ingram and Slayton have each seen 15 targets through 2 games. Golden Tate saw 5 targets last week. Sterling Shepard and Saquon Barkley are leaving 19 targets behind. And they're the pieces on the Giants likeliest to move the needle in this game. Ingram is a bet-on-volume and hope-for-touchdowns play. With his short-area looks, Tate could be thrown into this category as well, while Slayton will be used in the downfield and intermediate areas, and is the piece that is likeliest to drive this game forward if any fantasy goodness is going to come from this spot. That is to say, Slayton is the best bet for a big play, and it will likely take a big play or two for anything big to get stirred up in this game. I'm not sure if I'll end up with exposure to this game myself, but if I do, I'll likely start my rosters at Slayton and work my way outward from there.
The Raiders at the Patriots. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern, with an over-under of 47.5. Game Overview. The Raiders will lean balanced toward the run on offense while focusing their attention on Jacobs and Waller. The Patriots will likely land in between their extreme lack of passing volume in Week 1 and their extreme passing volume in Week 2. Scoring should finish in a tight range around what Vegas projects, though there are a few ways for the total to swing upward or downward. I won't have a large number of pieces from this game, but I expect to have 2 or 3 guys from this game in my late week player pool. How Las Vegas will try to win. There are a number of key 2019 rules that overlap in this game in interesting ways. Here were the 3 general rules on the Raiders in 2019 for plus EV DFS play. 1. Don't rely on Raiders wideouts on anything but a small percentage of MME play. 2. Only roster Josh Jacobs in spots where the Raiders will have a lead and/or Jacobs is likely to score multiple touchdowns on the ground. 3. Always consider Waller and give him a boost in matchups where the Raiders may have to pass more often as the game moves along. Here were the three general rules for teams playing the Patriots in 2019. 1. Don't play wide receivers. The Patriots were top of the league in everything against the pass last year, and they gave up only 4 touchdowns to wide receivers all season. Buffalo gave up the second fewest with 6, the next closest team allowed 9, 5 teams allowed 20+. 2. Don't roster running backs against them. The Patriots allowed 1 rushing touchdown to rushing backs all season. This was their 4th year in a low-ranking top 3 in this category. The last time the Patriots allowed more than 7 rushing touchdowns to running backs in a season was 2011, giving us 8 consecutive seasons in which they've allowed under 0.5 rushing touchdowns per game to running backs. The Patriots, philosophically, are going to force teams to score through the air when they get close to the goal line. 3. Only play tight ends against the Patriots who are good enough to beat Patrick Chung in coverage. We'll circle back in the game flow segment to the way these rules come together this week, but first, we know Jon Gruden is going to lean balance toward the run. The only teams last year that ran the ball at a higher rate than the Raiders were the teams from last year you first think of when you think of run-heavy. Baltimore, San Francisco, Tennessee, Minnesota, Indianapolis, Seattle, and Buffalo. We know that this team will work outward from there, throwing to the middle of the field at a higher rate than most teams, working from Waller to Hunter Renfrow from the perimeter. How New England will try to win. The Patriots went run-heavy against the Dolphins and pass-heavy against the Seahawks, while this game should see them somewhat in the middle. To back that up, the Dolphins faced the 5th-highest rush play rate last year. The Seahawks faced the 8th-highest pass play rate. The Patriots tracked toward both of those setups, while the Raiders ranked right around the middle of the league a year ago. This is a completely new Patriots offense, so there is obviously some guesswork involved, but a balanced attack would make the most sense here. The Raiders ranked top 5 in adjusted line yards on defense last year, but they rank bottom 5 so far this season, and their linebackers are better suited to coverage than to run stopping. This should allow the Patriots to find enough success on the ground to keep the chains moving this way, while the matchup against an attackable Vegas secondary should keep them attacking through the air. In Week 1, Cam Newton threw the ball only 19 times. In Week 2, he threw the ball 44 times. Somewhere in the middle is a reasonable expectation here, with something like 31 pass attempts and 10 rushes his likeliest starting point for quantity and distribution of touches. When taking to the air, N'Keal Harry and Julian Edelman, 18 targets apiece, will be the primary targets, while minimum price speedster Damier Byrd, who saw 9 targets last week, 1 week after I used him on a couple of rosters against the Dolphins and he saw 0 targets, will have a chance to rack up looks as the number 3 weapon here if the Patriots take to the air often enough. Likeliest game flow. Josh Jacobs has averaged 4.5 targets per game. Henry Ruggs has averaged 4 targets. Hunter Renfrow has averaged 2.5 targets. Brian Edwards has averaged 1.5 targets. Nelson Agholor and Jason Witten have averaged 1 target per game. Zay Jones and Fabian Moreau have averaged 0.5 targets per game. Darren Waller has averaged 12 targets per game. Of course, the first thing this means is that Bill Belichick will be focusing primarily on forcing the Raiders to beat them with other weapons. This doesn't mean Waller won't be targeted, and with Patrick Chung opting out of this season, the matchup is softer than it would have been a year ago. But ultimately, this could hurt Waller on the whole, as the Patriots might have been content to allow Chung and Waller to battle it out. But now, their chances of getting creative in how they scheme to stop Waller go up. This type of exploration would typically go in the interpretation segment. But because the Raiders are so heavily dependent on Waller and Jacobs for their production, this could have a fairly large impact on the way this game plays out. Meanwhile, the Raiders are down Richie Incognito on an offensive line behind which Jacobs is currently averaging only 3.5 yards per carry. The Raiders should be able to find a way to score points in this game, but 17 to 23 points is their likeliest range. Checking Vegas, the Raiders are pegged at 20.75, which looks just about right. Everything in the Patriots' offense right now is built around Cam. 63 pass attempts, 26 rush attempts. And the Raiders don't have the pieces to slow him down for an entire game, putting New England's expected scoring range at 23 to 31. In all, this lines up exactly with the way Vegas has this game pegged. An over-under of 47.5 with the Patriots implied for just under 27 points and the Raiders implied for just under 21. New England won't necessarily have to lead the entire game, but they are the team likelier to control this game and be playing with the lead. Tributaries. There are no very clear tributaries here. But whenever you have players who can score from anywhere on the field, with Henry Ruggs very much falling into this category, scoring can take off more quickly in a game. And anytime you have two teams that are comfortable going run heavy, scoring can disappoint. This gives us a slightly broader range of outcomes than can be fully captured by an over-under. But most of the scenarios for this game would still have it falling in a tight range around 47. DFS Plus Interpretation. Josh Jacobs has touched the ball 29.5 times per game in the early going, which is enough to make him a consider him in literally any matchup play. The long history of New England limiting scoring on the ground lowers my excitement here, though I could also see the Patriots slowing down Waller and the Raiders having to lean on Jacobs through the air as a result. For my own play, assuming there is enough to like at running back in other games, this is the fifth game I have researched so far, which leaves eight remaining. I'll likely leave Jacobs alone. The only way I would see myself going here would be if I had a heavy dose of Waller, in which case I would see Jacobs as the guy likeliest to succeed if Waller disappoints. But I will never argue against rostering a talented back who is seeing 29.5 touches per game in the early going if you like Jacobs this week yourself. Waller is a fine play, as in, of course he's solid, but he's also going to be priced about where his role should have him, and the Patriots are highly likely to design a large chunk of their defensive game plan around trying to slow him down. And I have no argument against rostering him. Given the downside risk and the likely elevated ownership, I may just stay away, but in a vacuum, I almost always like Waller as a play. On the Patriots side, Cam is the main guy to look toward, as this entire offense, at present, is built off what Cam allows them to do. Cam is in play in single entry, three entry max tourneys, and he's in large field play, and can be played naked or with one of his receivers. Edelman, Harry, Bird are the pecking order for production, while Harry, Edelman, and Bird might just be the DFS rankings with price factored in. Harry and Edelman each have 18 targets and 13 receptions. Edelman has the big advantage in yards, but Harry is actually the player likelier to see the downfield looks. Bird is stone minimum on both sites and is a risk-reward play. We've seen him get 0 targets, we've seen him get 9 targets. This week, he's likeliest to land in the middle as Cam lands in the middle for pass attempts, but his range could swing wildly from there. I was thinking of setting a rule of only roster a Patriots receiver if you're also rostering Cam, though Harry and Bird are cheap enough, and Harry in particular is involved enough, that I could see using one of these guys as a bottom-up piece. I would only use the Patriots running backs if betting heavily on Cam across a bunch of rosters and wanting to add in some hedges elsewhere. Cam is the Patriots' run game at the moment.
The Titans at the Vikings. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern, with an over-under of 49.5. Game overview. The Vikings are banged up and will look to lean on the run. The Titans will look to lean on the run and are also well set up through the air. This game could be higher scoring than most in the DFS community will give it credit for. It's difficult to isolate individual pieces from this game to fall in love with on single-entry, three-entry max builds, but there are some ways to bet on this game environment as a whole. How Minnesota will try to win. The Vikings, correctly or incorrectly, see themselves as a playoff team, and they are also a well-coached team. At 0-2, the chances are high that they will come out focused and ready to play well in this one, whatever that means, given the step back their offense has taken so far in the absence of Stephon Diggs, and given all the talent loss on defense, between offseason and injuries. Javier Rhodes, Trey Waynes, Linval Joseph, Everson Griffin, Danielle Hunter, Anthony Barr. Unfortunately for Minnesota, they will be taking on a Tennessee team that goes fairly opponent-specific in their defensive game plans, likely leading to a force the Vikings to win with anyone but Dalvin Cook and Adam Thielen approach. Not that the Titans will be 100% successful in this approach, but expect it to be their focus. And that sets up well on offense to take advantage of the depleted Vikings defense. Look for Minnesota to try to keep the ball on the ground for as long as they can when they're in possession, and look for them to try to tighten up downfield and force long drives from the Titans' offense. Minnesota will know they can't necessarily force stops here, but they can force Tennessee to go on long drives that require them to play mistake-free football. How Tennessee will try to win. The Titans want to force linebackers and safeties to pay attention to Derrick Henry, as this allows them to run Jonnu Smith and wide receivers horizontally or diagonally through multiple zones of the defense. With the linebackers and safeties pulled forward by Henry and pulled side to side by the action in the pass game, holes eventually open up, and Arthur Smith is then able to get into a play-calling rhythm that finds and exploits the holes that are created. Against a talent-depleted, zone-leaning defense like Zimmer's, the Titans are set up well for success. A.J. Brown is expected to miss another week, so we'll take a look at how this game sets up for DFS in the interpretation segment. But one way or another, the Titans should find ways to maneuver down the field against the Vikings' defense. Likeliest game flow. Last season, both of these teams finished top 4 in rush play rate, and both defenses ranked top 3 in fewest rushes allowed of 20-plus yards. The Vikings ranked 2nd, allowing only 5 such rushes all year. The Titans tied with the Steelers and Patriots in 3rd place at 6 such rushes allowed. The Vikings are the team likelier to crack in this area, but they are still going to be a fundamentally sound defense that makes big plays more difficult for the opponents. Last season, for example, the Vikings shaved almost 25% off the league average yak per reception rate, by far the best mark in the league. The Titans, by the way, shaved almost 8% off themselves. These two teams are fairly similar in a lot of their general philosophies and approaches. Tennessee is the better team, but both of these teams are fundamentally going to be good in the red zone. While the Titans struggled to defend in the red zone last year, finishing bottom 5 in opponent red zone touchdown rate, the Vikings, for whatever it's worth, were the 2nd best defense in the red zone a season ago. The raw ceiling on this game is somewhat capped by the way each of these teams likes to win games, but we nevertheless have some sneaky high-scoring potential here, with good coaches all the way around and with some good offensive pieces. The Titans are likelier to control this game, but it's likely to remain competitive throughout. This would likely leave each team at 31 or fewer pass attempts. In his last 12 games, including playoffs, Ryan Tannehill has topped 27 pass attempts only 3 times, while Kirk Cousins has gone 7 consecutive games with 31 or fewer pass attempts, and would likely give each running back a clear path to 23-plus touches. Scoring should come from in close rather than from big plays, giving a bump to running backs, though Jonnu, Corey Davis, and Adam Thielen are all used near the end zone as well. And the ultimate outcome of the game may depend on whether these teams are scoring touchdowns or are settling for field goals. 23-20 is about the lowest score we would expect here, with a clear upside to something like a 24-27 game or even a 27-31 game. Before last week, the Vikings game totals had hit 49-plus in 5 consecutive games against non-division opponents, while the Titans have quietly scored 31-plus points in 6 of their last 9 regular season games. I haven't yet looked at the over-under, but I'm guessing it's around 45.5 or maybe even 46.5, which would look slightly high for these two teams at first glance. But I would actually go as high as 48.5 here myself. Wow. Good on Vegas. They have this game at 49.0 as of Wednesday night, though after digging in on a deeper level, I guess it's more good on the early week sharps. This line opened at 45.5 before quickly being bet up. Scoring would finish in a tight range around these numbers in most scenarios, but when it's all said and done, there's a good chance here that both teams find a way to put up points. DFS Plus interpretation. Games in which the total is moving up aggressively are always spots we should pay attention to as DFS players. As for me, at least, this is further deepened by the fact that Vegas started this line right where I expected to find it, and the line has since moved right where I would have set it. The public thinks of low scoring when they see these names, and that may help lower ownership in DFS this weekend. Of course, it's a little more difficult to recommend how to play this spot, as Dalvin Cook and Derrick Henry are both priced high enough that they need multiple scores simply to reach value, as neither team is passing enough to give their back a serious pass game boost, especially the Titans, who pass even less than the Vikings and who use Henry far less in the pass game. Beyond this, the pass game volume is too low to make any of these pass catchers more than a bet on touchdown play as well. In most game scripts here, Thielen will max out at 10 or 11 targets, and his likeliest range is 8 to 9, which is fine, but is still tough to pay up for when guys with bigger downfield roles and a much clearer shot at double digits are also hanging out in his price range, and when the Titans are the sort of team that can be more purposeful than most in forcing the Vikings to beat them away from Thielen. Thielen will see his targets no matter what, but the matchup cuts off a lot of his pass to a truly high target game, and many of the targets he sees are likely to be in tight windows. In spots like this, I prefer to bet on the game environment rather than isolating individual plays, and if betting on the game environment, the place I would actually want to start is Tannehill, who gets you some leverage in the fact that no one ever thinks of rostering him,
while giving you enough upside to be worth the perceived risk. Tanny has gone for 25-plus DraftKings points in 5 of his last 10 regular season games, 22-plus on FanDuel, with only one game below 17.9 points. We're a ways away from the weekend, but I could see myself ending up with something like 3 Tannehill rosters on a 26-roster block. One with Janu, 5 targets last week, one with Davis, 5 targets last week, and one with Tanny naked. I might then bring one of those back with Dalvin, one of those back with Thielen, and one of those back with both. And then I might hedge with a couple of Henry rosters, betting that if Tanny disappoints, it will be because Henry is having a big day. Outside of these isolated bets, I wouldn't be rostering players from this game, but this would get me exposure on my roster block, in case the points in this game concentrate on the cornerstone pieces of these offenses. The Washington football team at the Browns kick off September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 44. Game overview. We're still gathering information here, but signs are beginning to point to the Browns as a run-leaning attack. Washington should continue to be inconsistent moving the ball, so they'll hope to win by creating short fields and capitalizing on mistakes. This is the sort of game in which more drives could end in field goals than in touchdowns. There are pieces to consider on each of these teams each week, though nothing that jumps off the page. How Cleveland will try to win. There was a lot of conversation this offseason over whether Kevin Stefanski was truly a run-heavy coach or had instead been forced to go run-heavy by Mike Zimmer. Well, 2 weeks in, and only the Chargers, Zimmer's Vikings, the Rams, and the Bears have run the ball at a higher rate when the score is within 7 points. Now, it should be noted that the Browns threw the ball more than they likely wanted to while getting stomped by the Ravens in Week 1, and they followed that up in Week 2 with a game against a Bengals team that will be among the easiest teams in the league this year to attack on the ground. We're still compiling information on this new Browns offense, but we'll take what we know and keep building from there. As expected, Stefanski has installed a lot of Vikings concepts for the Browns, with opportunities for the run action to flow one way and the pass action to boot out the other. Between these play designs and the pass rush of Washington, the Browns will likely need to sustain drives in order to put up points. Big plays will be harder to come by, which puts a dent in the scoring ceiling in this spot as a whole. But between the talent this offense has in the backfield and the weapons they can lean on downfield, Cleveland should eventually find success one way or another in this spot. How Washington will try to win. It's a little early to say with any certainty what this Browns defense is. They've so far held running backs in check, which was not the case last season, and they've given up over 600 passing yards and 6 touchdowns through the air while notching 0 interceptions. But they've also played Lamar Jackson in Week 1 and faced 61 pass attempts from Joe Burrow in Week 2, holding Burrow to only 5.2 yards per attempt. With their pass rush and their talent in the secondary, Cleveland should be able to make life more difficult than average, at least, for Dwayne Haskins. And Haskins will always create some unforced errors himself, whether it's bad decisions, bad passes, or both. Through 2 games, against the not-great secondaries of the Eagles and Cardinals, Haskins has managed to complete only 56% of his passes, with an average of 200.5 yards per game, while Washington has leaned on the run at an above-average rate, 11th in the league in rush play rate so far. Scott Turner's attack is going to aim for points and chunk plays when they have the ball, occasional downfield shots and plays that aim to get playmakers into space. But Washington's hope in this spot will be that they can create enough short fields for their offense and stall drives for Cleveland to win a close, lower-scoring game. Likeliest game flow. Each team will hit for a few big plays here. Between Terry McLaurin, Antonio Gibson, Odell Beckham, Nick Chubb, and Kareem Hunt, there are plenty of individual pieces that can self-create upside. But big plays will not be the story of this game, which means each team will ultimately be looking to march down the field in order to produce points. This is noteworthy, as Washington ranks dead last in third down conversion rate this year, more through self-inflicted wounds than through anything else, while Cleveland ranks 21st in third down conversions themselves, and they'll be taking on a Washington D that has been the 7th toughest in the league so far to convert on third down against. This is the sort of game in which we could see 8 to 10 scores, but with only 3 to 5 touchdowns. That would create a rough range of 36 to 50 total points, and I could see the total being about 43.5. After checking, Vegas has it at 44, so that's right on the schedule. And the chances of this game flying past 50 are slim. DFS Plus interpretation.
While this game isn't a game that has many clear paths to a shootout environment, there are explosive enough pieces on these teams that we need to dig down into the individual players in almost any matchup. The first place I want to start is in the Washington backfield, where Antonio Gibson, as we projected last week might be the case, saw a huge jump in snap rate, playing 43 of 66 snaps, 65.2%, or right in range where a typical lead back would be, while being heavily featured in the first half once again. He finished the day with only 13 carries and 2 targets, but the 20-touch, 4-catch game is coming at some point. This spot doesn't point to Gibson, as he's a road underdog running back going against a team that has defended the run well so far this year, but he remains in the bet-on-overlooked upside tournament pool. Through 2 games, Haskins has thrown 64 passes. More than half of these passes have gone to McLaurin and Logan Thomas, 17 looks apiece. People tend to avoid McLaurin because of his attachment to the erratic Haskins, but it's worth noting that their connection has been fairly stable, with 24 completions on 31 attempts, 77.4%, across their last 4 games together. McLaurin is going to be involved, and he's always a relatively risk-free, high-upside play. Wideouts always carry some floor risk, but for a wideout, McLaurin's floor has been consistently solid with Haskins under center. Thomas has only 63 yards so far on 17 targets, but he's facing a Cleveland defense that has been pasted by Mark Andrews, 5 for 58 and 2, and CJ Uzoma slash Drew Sample already, 11 for 87 and 1. He's in the cheap tight end mix on DK, and while tight end pricing is more condensed on FanDuel, he does maintain dart throw appeal as a likely lower-owned guy who has slim paths to a multi-touchdown game. On the Browns' side, the backfield has become a true split under Stefanski, with Nick Chubb playing snap counts of 35 and 36, and with Kareem Hunt playing snap counts of 36 and 20. Chubb is likelier to get the heavier workload in this one, as Cleveland should be able to eventually play with a lead. But each back will have a genuine role, which leaves each as a hope for efficiency, bet on big plays and touchdowns option. Through the air, the main thing that may hold back the stats is the likelihood of Cleveland staying under 32 or 33 pass attempts. The Browns have spread out the ball so far, with targets among the core pieces as follows. 16 to Beckham, 9 to Jarvis Landry, 8 to Hunt, 5 to Austin Hooper, 2 to Chubb. If they're playing from in front, it will be tough to bet on more than busted plays and or touchdowns for the Cleveland passing attack. This makes them a better unit to bet on as a whole than as isolated pieces, i.e. saying, I think this passing attack will do really well, so I'll mix and match some pieces across multiple rosters, rather than saying, I think X will do really well, so I'll lock him into a bunch of my builds. And I imagine I'll likely be skipping this passing attack on my own builds this week. The Rams at the Bills. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 47. Game overview. Buffalo has been winning through the air, but it wouldn't be surprising if they lean more run-heavy here. The Rams have been winning through the run and short passing attack, which should continue in this spot. It's likely that this game finishes within a tight range of scoring in the mid-40s, game total. But it's not difficult to see a low 40s or even mid to high 30s game, and it's not difficult to see this game finishing in the low 50s. Because of a variety of factors, no pieces from this game are likely to make my roster block unless I build a roster or two specifically focused on this game, with one possible exception. How Buffalo will try to win. The Rams have faced 2 passing attacks so far that like to attack downfield, the Cowboys and the Eagles. They have blitzed only 15.7% of the time, the third lowest rate in the league, and have instead played 7 men in coverage to force the third shallowest average yards per pass attempt in the NFL. Note, this is very impressive. It's difficult to face this Cowboys team and this Eagles team and allow only 6.2 yards per pass attempt. Furthermore, the Rams forced the Cowboys to completely shorten up the root trees for both Amari Cooper and CeeDee Lamb, while they did the same to Philadelphia and DeSean Jackson. This is especially noteworthy because Bills offensive coordinator Brian Daboll prides himself on being one of the more opponent-specific coaches in the league. The Rams have been easier to attack on the ground so far, with 4.8 yards allowed per carry to running backs, without a single run of 40-plus yards yet allowed. I.e., the Rams are consistently giving up yards, as evidenced by their 31st-placed ranking in adjusted line yards. There is obviously open territory to play this game a different way on your rosters, but after the Bills were one of the most pass-aggressive teams the first 2 weeks against the Jets and Dolphins, we should expect them to swing over to something of more a run-leaning attack in this spot. How the Rams will try to win. Speaking of run-leaning attacks, no team in the NFL has run the ball at a higher rate than the Rams so far. While the Bills are easier to attack on the ground than they are through the air, they were middle of the pack in adjusted line yards last year, and they ranked 21st so far in 2020. So far, Jared Goff has attempted 31 and 27 pass attempts, and his average intended air yards of 6.4 ranks bottom 5 in the league. Not that this is necessarily an indictment against him. Other quarterbacks near the bottom of the league right now include Patrick Mahomes and Ben Roethlisberger, while Drew Brees is a staple at the bottom of the league these days. But it does paint a picture for you of how this offense is choosing to attack. Only three teams have racked up a higher time of possession per drive than the Rams. The Bills also rank right behind the Rams, though this is less impressive given the competition they've faced so far. And only five teams have averaged more plays per drive than the Rams. Look for LA to continue down this path in Week 3, building their passing attack off their run game, and letting that run game carry them down the field on long, mistake-free drives. Likeliest game flow. Each of these offenses can score points, but neither team is a natural shootout producer. Buffalo has a strong defense and is opponent-specific in its game plans. The Rams have shown anti-shootout tendencies in the way they've played defense thus far, taking away downfield passing, and in the way they've played offense, run-heavy with the passing attack focused on the short areas of the field. Unless the Bills break through against the Rams in a way we aren't quite used to seeing Josh Allen break through against good defenses that look to force an opponent to march down the field, or unless the Rams suddenly decide to lean pass-heavy and attack downfield against the strong Buffalo secondary, it will be difficult for this game to truly break out. The over-under here would have been aggressive at 46.5, but after opening at 44.5, it was bet up to 48. Sanity kicked in shortly before this write-up with the line being pressured back down to 47, which is closer to where I would have had it myself. I would have said 46.5 and called the under a slightly favorable bet, which is to say that each team is likely to find a way to score points in this spot, but a true blow-up game is difficult to lean into here. Another way to look at this is that Buffalo's Week 3 pricing has been set based on their performance to date against the Jets and the Dolphins, and this is a much tougher matchup, while the Rams' Week 3 pricing has been set based on their performance to date against the Cowboys and Eagles, and this is a much tougher matchup. Tributaries. If you've watched Josh Allen with as much blessed love and enthusiasm as I have over the last 2+ seasons, you know that he shows improvement on nearly a week-to-week basis. But we still haven't seen 2020 Josh Allen against a non-bad defense. In his last 12 start-to-finish regular season games last year, he failed to top 185 passing yards 6 times, and he topped 208 passing yards only 4 times. The rushing upside helps in fantasy. He's typically getting 30 to 40 on the ground, which is basically worth a passing touchdown, and he's scored 7 rushing touchdowns in his last 11 regular season games. But in their last 18 regular season games, Buffalo has topped 17 points in only half of them. 3 of those 9 games over 17 came against the Dolphins, all 3 of which were the Bills' only games north of 28, and only 4 more games topped 21, versus the Giants, versus Washington, versus Dallas, and versus the Jets. It wouldn't be surprising if the Rams come out of this one with a 23-17 win. On the flip side, whenever I argue that hard against a team's ability to put up points, it almost inevitably seems as though I'm doing so because I can sense that something is going to break against logic in the spot in question. The truth is, the Bills are not quite the offense they showed the last 2 weeks, but that doesn't mean they are incapable of being that offense in the small sample size of one game against the Rams. Although LA is focusing short area in their passing attack, they are precise and consistent enough to put up points, while Buffalo has upside to burn. This game could end up as something like 27-24, or even 31-27, and no one would be too terribly surprised. DFS Plus Interpretation. I'll get to the Buffalo backfield in a minute, but taking into account all other elements in this game, here's what we essentially have. Summary of this spot for DFS. The Rams have a good offense, but they are taking on a really good Buffalo defense, and their passing attack is priced as if this is 2018. Cooper Kupp has an average depth of target of 3.9, that's like impossibly short, while Robert Woods is also playing ridiculously short area at an ADOT of 6.0. They are taking on one of the toughest pass defenses in the league and are priced as if the Rams are a downfield attacking pass-heavy team instead of a short area run-heavy team, making them guys who can obviously hit in this offense, but who cost more than they should and always grab some ownership. DFS chalk favorite Tyler Higbee, by the way, saw 5 targets last week, 4 in week 1. He's the second highest priced tight end on DK this week, and the 4th highest priced on FanDuel. In the backfield, we have Malcolm Brown set to join Daryl Henderson this week as a 1-2 punch with uncertain distribution. In week 1, the Rams gave Brown 44 of 73 snaps and gave Henderson only 5, while Henderson popped in week 2 after Brown got hurt. I would expect a fairly even split here with Cam Akers out, making each a bet-on-touchdown play. The Bills are dealing with soaring price tags and likely increased attention from the DFS public, and are now taking on a Rams team that has designed itself to take away downfield passing. Buffalo is also adaptable, and the Rams have ranked 31st in adjusted line yards so far after ranking 16th a year ago. Josh Allen, Stephon Diggs, and John Brown are always in play. As you know, I've been here both weeks so far, on Allen and Diggs in week 1, and on Allen in week 2. But I'll be viewing this as a spot I only want to bet on if betting on the game environment as a whole. Unless I'm taking multiple pieces from this game on a single roster, I don't expect to be taking any of the pieces from this game that have been hit on so far. The one area that does move to the forefront in this game for me, outside of game-focused rosters, is the Buffalo rushing attack if Zach Moss is out. Moss has not practiced this week through Thursday. If that continues Friday, Devin Singletary could be set up for 80% of the snaps, as Buffalo has only oft-inactive TJ Yeldon and special teamer Tywan Jones behind these two. Singletary played 52 of 54 snaps last week 16, and he played 60 of 73 snaps last week 14, so they don't mind giving him work. Singletary has only 2 rushing touchdowns so far in his career. Moss out boosts Josh Allen's rushing touchdowns expectations more than Singletary's, and he has topped 3 receptions only 3 times. He's no slam dunk, but 2 for 20 through the air is a fair floor, with room to grow from there. And 70 yards on the ground is almost a gimme if Moss is out. I don't expect to have a ton of exposure to this game myself, but I will be keeping Singletary on my late week list.
The Bears at the Falcons kick off Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 47. Game overview. Atlanta will be swimming against the current in this one, as the Bears will be working to slow this game down and limit the scoring that occurs. Atlanta has the edge here, and while their scoring projection is lower than it will be in many other spots this year, they should still be able to put up points. The Bears' scoring projection is higher than it will be in many other spots this year, but their best shot at a win will be a lower-scoring game. From a price-considered standpoint, not a whole lot jumps off the page in this spot for me, but from a roster construction standpoint, there are at least a few pieces to consider, and there is certainly an upside to be targeted in tourneys. How Atlanta will try to win. This is a story of two different teams. The Bears rank 24th in pace of play. The Falcons rank 4th. The Bears rank 24th in pass play rate. The Falcons rank 5th. The Bears defense has allowed the 8th lowest opponent drive success rate. The Falcons defense has allowed the 5th highest. The Falcons are built to pass the ball, and with this game being played in their home dome, we should expect them to do exactly that. But unlike the first 2 weeks, when they were taking on the beatable secondaries of the Seahawks and Cowboys, Atlanta will have to deal with a still-solid Bears defense that shaved 8.5% off the league average ADOT last year, and 11% off the league average yak per reception rate, and has picked up where they left off by holding Matthew Stafford and Daniel Jones below expectations, forcing them to work primarily in shorter areas of the field than those offenses would prefer. The Falcons are further hampered by the blown tire Julio Jones is dealing with. Julio has been battling a hamstring injury since before week 1, and reports indicate he aggravated it last week. He's likely to play, but he's missed a couple practices already. So while this is an offense that is always a threat for points, we'll likely see them working toward a more march-the-field approach than the attack-downfield approach that helped them pile up points on the scoreboard the last 2 weeks. How Chicago will try to win. The Bears would love to ask Mitchell Trubisky to throw the ball only around 30 times. In their 2-0 start, he has thrown the ball 36 and 28 times. And outside of Allen Robinson, 18 targets so far, and David Montgomery, 33 touches, they want to spread the ball around. Outside of Tariq Cohen, at 7.5 touches per game, no one else on the Bears has averaged more than 3 touches per game so far. Because so many of Chicago's offensive mistakes are self-created, poor reads by Trubisky, poor accuracy, etc., even a soft matchup doesn't guarantee a high number of drives that will end in a touchdown. which leaves this team trying to win games such as this one by lowering the final score as much as possible. Look for the Bears to try to take away downfield passing to force the Falcons to march the field. And when they have the ball, look for them to slow down the pace, play balanced on offense, and try to piece together sustained drives that end in points. Likeliest game flow. The Falcons' offense is too good to be held down by most opponents, and the likeliest scenario here has them creating enough quality drives or explosive plays to put up 4 or 5 scores. Through 2 games against softer competition, the Falcons have 7 offensive touchdowns, and if we played out this game 100 times, they might end up with around 2.8 touchdowns per game in this spot. But when it's all said and done, 23 to 27 points is a fair projection, and Atlanta is explosive enough that they could always climb from there. Even with the matchup boost, of course, the Bears' offense is less reliable than the Falcons' offense, but the matchup is soft enough and the Bears have enough things going for them that 4 scores is a fair projection, with 5 scores not at all out of the question. The Bears are likelier to win a low-scoring game than a high-scoring game, which is worth keeping in mind if betting on this game and wanting to take the Bears. Chicago plus the under is the likeliest way for this to play out if the Bears win or play within less than 3 points. Though I wouldn't flip that around the other way, as Atlanta could win by 10-plus points and still keep this game under its total if the Bears' offense fails to show up. But they should be able to do enough on offense in this game to keep the score respectable throughout, and to possibly even have a chance to win the game at the end. DFS Plus Interpretation. FanDuel does not aggressively adjust pricing for matchup, and oftentimes they don't adjust for matchup at all, while DraftKings has been less aggressive about their matchup adjustments the last couple of years than they were back in 2017-2018. Because of this, a Falcons team coming off back-to-back high-quality spots, and thus producing and thus seeing price tags rise, is a bit of a tough sell here from an optimal standpoint. And this game environment does not lend itself easily to a true shootout, which removes some of the other ways to attack here. With that said, Matt Ryan and this Dirk Koetter Falcons offense are always a strong bet for heavy passing volume. And if Julio is slowed enough to see only 7 or 8 looks, then this should once again allow Calvin Ridley to flirt with double digits, while giving Russell Gage and Hayden Hurst an opportunity to produce in the shorter areas of the field. After dealing with Jamal Adams in Week 1, Hurst saw 8 targets against Dallas and went 5 for 72 and 1. And he's the best overall play here. That is, Gage is a solid bet for 7 or more targets, with upside for 9 or 10 looks, and he actually has the best matchup among Atlanta wideouts against Buster Skrine in the slot. But with this short area role, it's tough for him to produce a slate-breaking score, making him more roster for floor, hope for touchdowns. Hurst, on the other hand, is also a strong bet for 7 or 8 targets, but he plays a position where duds are more frequent, and where a fairly bankable workload therefore has more intrinsic value to your roster. On top of this, Hurst does have upside, making him a more valuable all-around play. But any of these Falcons pass catchers can be considered this week, as is the case any week in this offense. The Bears are tempting this week in the way Trubisky was tempting each of the last 2 weeks, and in the way all teams will be tempting against the Falcons this year. Even if there are signs that point to downside, the upside stands out. Trubisky's chances of a big price-considered game are heightened by the fact that the Bears should need to score more points here in order to keep pace, while the matchup should bail him out of a few of his mistakes. I'll likely avoid this side of the ball myself, but with the way the Bears have distributed volume thus far, Trubisky, A-Rob, and Montgomery are pieces that should be considered outside of pure dart-throw territory, with Trubisky the likely starting point for me if I were going here myself, followed by some Trubisky plus A-Rob, and, if I had enough Chicago pass exposure, some Montgomery hedge rosters from there. The Panthers at the Chargers kick off Sunday, September 27th at 4:05 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 43.5. Game Overview. This is not a good spot for Carolina, but in order to win, they will need to put up points, and that's what they'll be looking to do. This is a great spot for the Chargers, who had a lot of things going for them in Justin Herbert's first start. The Chargers should be playing with a lead here, while the Panthers will be hoping to keep the game close enough to steal a win at the end. There is plenty to consider in this spot in DFS, though there are a number of factors that may make this more of an isolate and attack spot than the sort of spot I want to spread across my rosters. How Carolina will try to win. This is a brutal spot for the upstart Panthers, with their offensive centerpiece out of action for a cross-country game against a Chargers defense that has held the Bengals to 13 points and the Chiefs to 23. The Chargers have a middling run defense and an elite pass defense, while Carolina's best weapons are now in the pass game. Joe Brady and Matt Rhule will know that the only way for the Panthers to win this game will be to score points, i.e., the Panthers' defense is bad enough that the Chargers will find their way onto the scoreboard throughout this game. So the Panthers can't just hope to shorten this game and wait for something to break their way, Adam Gase style. So we should be looking for them to attack with Mike Davis and their three main pieces in the pass game, DJ Moore, Curtis Samuel, and Robbie Anderson. But the Chargers are going to continue blitzing at the lowest rate in football because they're getting pressure on the quarterback at the fifth highest rate in football, and they are going to make it difficult for Carolina to sustain drives. When it's all said and done, Carolina will ultimately be hoping something lucky breaks their way here while doing what they can on offense to try to generate points. How the Chargers will try to win. Justin Herbert got away with some mistakes on Sunday that should have been interceptions, but he also made some wow throws, and he showed plenty of poise while sliding around in collapsing pockets and quickly processing through his reads. His mobility puts added strain on a defense, and his weapons give him a lot to work with in this spot. In fact, watching this offense at the moment reminds me a bit of watching Josh Allen's Bills down the stretch of 2018, when it was like, I wonder if most people realize how exciting this offense can be. The Shane Steichen, Justin Herbert offense was not a training wheels offense. Steichen is featuring plenty of movement and misdirection to strain the defense pre-snap, while building in concepts that strain the defense both horizontally and vertically in play. Last week, they provided plenty of easy gains for Herbert on running back and wide receiver screens, and they gave Herbert a number of opportunities to make plays downfield, including multiple times when he passed up a covered deep throw for a quick check down to the running back. There will be some growing pains for this offense, assuming Herbert continues starting, which will almost certainly be the case when it's all said and done, regardless of what Anthony Lynn is currently saying. But there will also be some big games and soft matchups. This is a soft matchup. Furthermore, the Chargers, under Steichen, are playing at the fourth fastest situation neutral pace in the league. This is highly un-Chargers-like, so I'm not fully ready to lock this in as a trend, but Herbert was regularly snapping the ball with double digits left on the play clock, and nothing points to that changing this week. The Chargers aren't going to look to just shorten up this game and hopefully get out of here with a win. They're going to attack here, and they should have success in this matchup. The major concern is simply that Anthony Lynn offense would typically be the type to slow down if the lead begins to grow, which could dampen the true ceiling here if the Panthers fail to keep pace. Likeliest game flow. It's likeliest that we see the Chargers climb out to a lead here and maintain that lead throughout. Though it's also worth noting that we tend to think in terms of extremes, when the reality rarely plays out as such. In other words, the Chargers should take a lead, but it's not as if we should expect them to be up 28-3 at halftime and be killing out the clock all game from there. It's likely we'll see the Panthers in the second half trying to hold in place or regain a one-score deficit in the hopes of something breaking their way at the end, which could leave the Chargers in the fourth quarter turning to a slightly more conservative game plan as they look to prevent collapse. There really isn't a tributary in which the Panthers put up a bunch of points with sustained drives and turn this into a shootout. The Chargers' pass defense is just too good for that to happen, with 7 men in coverage and the defensive line getting to the quarterback quickly. But a Herbert turnover that leads to points for the Panthers wouldn't be a bad thing for the Chargers' fantasy production, and it's not outside the realm of possibility that the Panthers could put up 23 points and force the Chargers to aim for 30. DFS Plus interpretation. I didn't expect to have much interest in this game, and I expected to come in here and hammer it down as a trap. I know Anthony Lynn well enough to not see soft matchup and immediately think smash spot. But Herbert threw 7 passes of 20-plus yards last week, and perhaps even more importantly, he was 16 of 20 on his passes within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage, as Steichen gave him open players on creative route combos or screenplays or checkdowns, all of which could lead to easy gains. This allowed the Chargers to keep the sticks moving, and along the way, they leaned run-heavy against the soft-run defense of the Chiefs. This week, the Chargers are playing a Panthers team that allowed the most running back rushing yards in the NFL a season ago. And that has picked up where they left off with the 6th most RB rush yards and the most RB rush touchdowns allowed already. The Panthers have also given up the 6th most RB receiving yards as a bonus, In fact, in both rush yards and receiving yards allowed to running backs, the Panthers rank right next to the Chargers' Week 2 opponent, the Chiefs. But where the Chiefs have allowed only one touchdown to running backs, the Panthers have allowed six. I'm not penciling in Herbert for more than 30 pass attempts. Anything over that will be a bonus. But with only five targets so far this year flowing outside the five main pieces for the Chargers, this still provides plenty of targets to work with in DFS. Keenan Allen, 8 targets to 10 targets. Mike Williams, 9 targets to 4 targets. Hunter Henry, 8 targets to 8 targets. Austin Eckler, 1 target to 4 targets. Joshua Kelly, 0 targets to 2 targets. Henry is the player I like most here, as the tight end position is always a tough place to find floor and ceiling. He's gone for 73 and 83 yards, and the touchdowns will come. Allen is a strong bet for 8 or more looks once again, and his involvement in the screen game last week gives him some opportunities for a big game in spite of his typically shorter area role. He was also used on multiple downfield looks last week. Williams saw only 4 targets last week, but that was more a product of the Chiefs' ability to take away downfield passing than any decision on the part of the Chargers to limit his usage. I would feel pretty comfortable scooping some of Eckler's Week 2 targets back over to Williams as Eckler and Kelly were hit on some dump-offs after Herbert didn't like what he saw downfield. This week, in this matchup, it's likelier that Williams will be given 6 or 7 shots downfield. Eckler is becoming a tough sell at his elevated price tag, as he played 56.6% of the snaps last week to 51.8% for Kelly, while touching the ball 20 times to Kelly's 25. Through 2 games, Eckler has 40 touches and Kelly has 37, and Kelly should grab lower ownership at a lower price, making him the slightly sharper play, especially as he has 6 carries inside the 10 and 3 inside the 5, to only 1 carry inside the 10 for Eckler and 0 inside the 5. The slightly on the sharper play label is due to the disparity in the pass game role, where Eckler is running 3 times as many routes as Kelly. We want catches and touchdowns from running backs. Eckler is the much better bet for catches. Kelly is the much better bet for touchdowns. Each player has a high ceiling, but each has a low floor. Eckler in a price-considered sense, and Kelly for the fact that he could have a nice day with 18 carries for 90 yards, and that would do very little for you in DFS without a touchdown, or, on DK, a 100-yard bonus. This is a good spot for a touchdown or two from Kelly, and both guys can hit for big plays, but neither comes with a safe bottom to this range. I'm not quite sure yet how I'll be playing all this myself. The split workload for the Chargers, plus the lack of locked-in pass game work for the preferred back, Kelly, plus the price tag on Keenan Allen, plus the boom-bust nature of Mike Williams, may all add up to make this a spot I bet on with an isolated group of rosters on my roster block while avoiding this game elsewhere on my roster block. In other words, making strategic bets around this offense, but otherwise leaving this offense alone. I'll definitely have some exposure here. I'll have a slightly better feel by the player grid, and a much better feel by any player grid updates overnight on Saturday to Sunday, of what exposure will look like. On the other side of the ball, avoiding players against the Chargers has been highly profitable the last couple of years. The risk of a dud against this defense is always relatively high, while the hits are rarely big enough to justify the risk. But if wanting to go here, the locked-in workloads on all 3 receivers can be targeted, with Moore having the best all-around role, Anderson benefiting from usage as a more intermediate receiver in this offense, and Samuel working much closer to the line of scrimmage this year than last year, but likely in line for a couple extra carries with Christian McCaffrey out. Mike Davis, of course, is a bet-on-volume play who should see around 18-plus carries and 3-5 receptions. If betting heavily on the Chargers, it could work to bring back a piece or two from the Panthers. If wanting to test the fates against the Chargers' defense, Carolina pieces could also be isolated as one-off plays.
Jets at Colts. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th, 4:05 p.m. Eastern, over-under 44. Game overview. The matchup and expected game environment should tilt the Colts toward being more balanced than they have been so far. One game pass heavy, one game run heavy. The Jets are treating their losses like wins, trying to ice away the game even when they fall far behind. This doesn't bode well for shootout potential. The Colts are likely to play with a lead, and the Jets are likely to drag down the momentum of this game like a lead weight. Jonathan Taylor is viable once again, while Mo Alie-Cox and T.Y. Hilton each have a few elements pointing their direction. How Indianapolis will try to win. After finishing top two in adjusted line yards on defense a year ago, the Jets already ranked top two for 2020 as well. In week two, they gave up an 80-yard touchdown to Raheem Mostert and a 55-yard run to Jerick McKinnon on a beautiful cutback on 3rd and 31. They also gave up a long touchdown run to Mostert that was called back due to holding. But outside of these plays, they allowed 27 yards on 23 carries to Mostert, Tevin Coleman, and Jeff Wilson, while allowing McKinnon to go 2 for 22 on his other two runs. Meanwhile, the Jets have allowed quarterbacks so far to go 55 of 73, 75.3%, for 514 yards, 4 touchdowns, and 0 interceptions. This creates an interesting setup. We know that Frank Reich is adaptable. We know that after going pass-heavy in 2018 with Andrew Luck, he went run-heavy in 2019 with Jacoby Brissett. And we know that after going pass-heavy in Week 1 against the Jags, he went run-heavy last week against the Vikings. The Colts have the best offensive line in football, but the 49ers' line is strong in its own right, and it was getting visibly blown up by the Jets last week, pointing to the pass game as the path of least resistance. Put it all together, and we should see Indy throwing the ball more this week than they did in last week's blowout win. 25 attempts for Phillip Rivers in that one, with 35 rush attempts between Jonathan Taylor, 26, and Jordan Wilkins, 9. Though the likelihood of the Colts controlling this game could still put a dent in pass game volume on the whole. How the Jets will try to win. The Jets are getting enough of a push with their offensive line, and Adam Gase is in love enough with the run, that the Jets will try to win on the ground pretty much regardless of what is happening in this game. Down 21-3 coming out of the half last week, starting with the ball inside his own 20, Gase and the Jets went run, run, pass that traveled 1 yard downfield on 3rd and 3. Down 24-6, three scores, with 27 seconds on the clock at the end of the third quarter, the Jets called a run and then let the clock go to the end of the quarter. Down 31-6 with 10:15 left in the game, down four scores, in a position where it was mathematically impossible for them to win unless they were throwing downfield, Gase opened the Jets' drive with a run. If the Jets force some turnovers and take a lead, they'll try to kill off this game. If the Jets fall behind, they'll try to kill off this game. Remember when Adam Gase coached under John Fox? What a pairing that was. The maddening thing about Gase is that if he can keep games close, he can figure out a way to win games he shouldn't. But this Jets team can't keep games close. And when they fall behind, they show no urgency, continuing to act as though they are killing off the clock the way they would with a lead. As we said in this space last week, if you know how the Jets should try to win this game, Gase would love to hear from you. Likeliest game flow. Either through a long run from Taylor, a couple sustained drives, or a big play to Mo Alie-Cox or T.Y. Hilton, the Colts are likely to take the lead. And once they have the lead, they are likely to hold on. The Jets, meanwhile, will drag down the momentum of this game like a lead weight, allowing the Colts to remain balanced, while eventually slowing down a bit on their end as both teams aim to ice away this game. The Colts with a lead, the Jets with a loss. Ultimately, the Colts should dominate here. If they don't, it will likely be because of mistakes that keep this game lower scoring, rather than from the Jets suddenly clicking and putting up big plays. DFS Plus interpretation. On the Colts' first play last week, they threw a swing pass to Jonathan Taylor. On the 15th play of that drive, they threw a pass to him on 3rd and 10. The matchup isn't great for Taylor, but it was evident last week, when he played 67.1% of snaps, that the Colts are going to involve him in this offense regardless of what they are doing. The matchup isn't great against the Jets, but the game environment works in Taylor's favor, making him a viable tourney play for upside if you want to go there. As a bonus, the Jets allowed the 6th most receiving yards to running backs last season. Taylor seems destined to see 20-plus touches regardless of matchup. So while the matchup is rough, his floor is relatively solid, and there is definitely upside. Through the air for Indy, volume is somewhat capped on all players, as it would take the Jets keeping pace in order for volume to truly spike. But with Paris Campbell out, and the Colts likely to throw more than 25 times, Hilton and Mo Alie-Cox are interesting targets in a game in which per-play efficiency should be elevated. 8 or more targets for Hilton, and 6 or more targets for Mac are fair median projections. Mac's role was awesomely downfield-focused last week. Of his 6 targets, 4 came 15-plus yards downfield, and 3 of those came 20-plus yards downfield, while Hilton ranks 7th in the NFL in percentage share of team air yards, and is a major regression candidate after catching only 50% of passes thrown his way so far. Last week, 3 of his 5 targets came 15-plus yards downfield, with 2 of them coming 30-plus yards. Even if the Colts don't throw the ball, Hilton lines up well for 6 or 7 looks against a very beatable secondary. Behind these core pieces for the Colts, Michael Pittman, 6 targets last week, and Zach Pascal, 4 targets last week, will soak up a bit of work. You need a role change for Pittman, who worked the short areas last week, or some luck from Pascal to help you win a tourney. But each guy will be on the field plenty in a good matchup if you want to chase. On the other side of the ball, the Colts, as we know, filter targets away from wide receivers and toward the middle of the field. This is not a talent-rich defense outside of the linebackers. But even at that, they have the talent edge over a Jets team that entered the season with one of the lowest talent offenses in the NFL, and is now likely to be missing all of Le'Veon Bell, Jamison Crowder, and Breshad Perriman this week. If chasing here for low-cost upside, Chris Herndon is the only player who stands out. Herndon has legitimate upside. The matchup tilts in his direction, and on DraftKings in particular, it's hard to get 4x from tight end no matter which price range you land in. So giving yourself exposure to a high-usage cheap guy can open paths to an edge if the guy hits, while keeping you relatively protected even if he doesn't. But if you want to get wild here, you could bet on volume being enough to create upside for Chris Hogan or Braxton Berrios. Or you could just trust that Gase is trying to hurt your rosters, and you could leave the rest of the Jets alone.
The Cowboys at the Seahawks kick off Sunday, September 27th at 4:25 p.m. Eastern, with an over-under of 56.5. Game overview. Seattle is not yet a pass-heavy team, but things line up for them to remain less run-heavy than they've been the past few years. Dallas will be working with fewer plays in this game than they had against the pace-up play of the Rams and Falcons, but the scoring environment as a whole remains strong. This is not the can't-miss game we had last week for the Cowboys, but this is still likely to be the highest scoring game on the slate. There is plenty to like here in DFS, of course, with our fairly standard and straightforward approach in place for both the Seahawks and the Cowboys. How Seattle will try to win. The pieces of the puzzle continue to come together. 2 weeks into the season, the Seahawks rank middle of the pack in pass play rate with the score within 7 points, instead of ranking near the bottom of the league. They rank 10th in first down pass play rate, and 11th in first down pass play rate with the score within 7 points. They are not a pass-heavy team, but they are continuing to show signs of being less run-heavy than they were in the past. Perhaps this is only temporary. Perhaps this is only because the Seahawks have played a pair of high-powered offenses. But this week, they're playing a high-powered offense again in the Cowboys. And the Dallas secondary, which entered the season ranked 22nd in the league by PFF, just put Anthony Brown on injured reserve. The Cowboys should prove attackable on the ground as well, but with the Cowboys likely to put up some points when they have the ball, we should again see most of the upside from Seattle offense coming through the incredible play of the best quarterback in the NFL. How Dallas will try to win. So far this season, Dallas ranks first in pace of play and first in situation neutral pace of play. Only 8 teams have thrown the ball at a higher rate than the Cowboys. And while Dallas has been a bit more balanced on early downs and with the score within 7 points, their pace has allowed Dak Prescott to attempt 39 and 47 attempts, while their pace and concentrated setup have allowed Ezekiel Elliott to still see 22 rush attempts in each game. With the Seahawks, 31st, playing at a much slower situation neutral pace than the Rams, 6th, or the Falcons, 5th, Dallas will have a tough time running quite so many plays in this spot. The situation neutral difference between Seattle and those other two teams is non-negligible, with the Seahawks using up nearly 7 additional seconds between each play. Multiply that by around 50 plays on which the clock continues running, and a good 5 minutes are lost from this game compared to what Dallas had the last 2 weeks. Dallas has averaged 11.5 drives per game so far, and 10 drives should be the expectation on this one. But they'll remain aggressive when they do have the ball, and against a Seattle defense that has struggled to defend the pass this season, they should be able to find ways to put points on the scoreboard. Likeliest game flow. Each of these teams ranks top 10 in drive success rate on offense, while the Seahawks rank bottom 11 in drive success rate on defense. The Cowboys rank in the top half of the league, but this is hardly a concern for Russ. We know that Pete Carroll coaches with the philosophy of giving his team a chance to win in the fourth quarter, so we'll feel better about betting on the Seahawks offense in spots where the Seahawks opponent can be expected to put up points. But given that this is one such spot, we should once again be able to pencil in 30-plus pass attempts for Russ, with a large chunk of these passes coming downfield. When Seattle is attacking, Seattle is almost always putting up points. All of this is enhanced by the fact that Mike McCarthy and the Cowboys will see the need in this game to remain aggressive throughout, which should again lead to bankable bets that can be made on this Cowboys offense with a narrow distribution of touches. It's worth noting, of course, that an over-under of 56 is a massive number. Seattle had only 5 games top that number last season, and the Cowboys had only 4 such games. This is also not the same can't-miss setup we had last week for the Cowboys, or the week before for the Seahawks, as the Falcons are a fast-paced, pass-heavy team themselves, and their defense is a shootout booster as well. Nevertheless, the over-under is sitting at 56 for a reason. Just because this isn't a spot like last week for the Cowboys and Falcons, it was the over-under is massive and it's still lower than it should be. Doesn't mean we shouldn't expect points. The Cowboys have too many weapons for Seattle to slow them down, and once Russ gets started, he's nearly impossible to stop. When it's all said and done, this game is going to be in the mix for the highest scoring spot on the weekend, and it won't be at all surprising if it tops all the other games on the slate. DFS Plus Interpretation. My Seattle rules the last couple of years have gone something like this. Only play Russ if also playing pieces from the other side of the game. In week 1, this would have paid off with Ridley, Julio, or Gage, all 3. In week 2, this would have paid off with Edelman or, price considered, Harry or Bird, or all 3. Only play Seattle wide receivers if you're playing Russ, and only play Seattle wide receivers on about half of your Russ rosters. Russ often puts up some tourney-winning scores without pulling his receivers with him. Russ has opened the season with back-to-back tourney-winning scores. Lockett and Metcalf have each posted a pair of solid games that you wouldn't be disappointed by, but that wouldn't boost you toward a tourney win. If playing Russ and multi-entering, hedge with Chris Carson on at least half as many rosters as you're playing Russ. Only this last rule goes out the window for me at the moment, as Carson is playing about 60% of the snaps. But Seattle seems to be playing things a bit cautiously at the moment as he returns from his 2019 hip injury. Carson has touched the ball 16 times per game so far, while Carlos Hyde has touched the ball 7 times per game, and Travis Homer has touched the ball 4 times per game. In the past, there were weeks when Carson might see 25-plus touches himself. But unless I were massively overweight on Russ, I would be looking for safer bets at running back than this. On the Dallas side, we have Dalton Schultz likely to draw ownership from the DFS public after his big game in Week 2, as he enters into what might be the toughest tight end matchup in football, one-on-one coverage from Jamal Adams. Adams is too valuable to the Seattle defense for them to waste him on Schultz all game, but the signs in this game point to Dallas losing about a drive and a half off their early season average, while at least slightly making up for this in DFS by pushing fewer targets to the tight end position this week and having more left over for Zeke and the wide receivers. This is a game environment spot, i.e., a spot where the first reason we would be betting on the Cowboys is because we would be expecting this game to end up with plenty of points on the scoreboard, which means we want to worry less about the matchup than about overall offensive environment for a group of receivers like the Cowboys. But the best matchup will belong to CeeDee Lamb in the slot, while Michael Gallup and Amari Cooper will obviously have plenty of opportunity to hit as well. I don't want to overreact to the early season sample, as Gallup is one of the best route runners in the league and is also running higher upside routes downfield. His ADOT of 18.8 ranks second in the league right now, dwarfing Amari's 9.9 and CeeDee's 6.9. But the pecking order for targets at the moment appears to be Amari, 23, Lamb, 15, and Gallup, 10. Amari leads in percentage share of team air yards as well, 36.3, an elite number, while Gallup is not far behind him at 29.8%. CeeDee Lamb has 16.3% of the Cowboys' available air yards and is a bet-on-floor, hope-for-ceiling option. Gallup is a bet-on-ceiling, hope-for-floor play. Amari is the best blend of the bunch. All three are very much in play in this spot and can be played with or without Seattle pieces. Finally, Seattle has been tough against the run this year, building off of last year, which lowers Zeke's floor against his high price tag this week. But Seattle is also attackable through the air with backs, and the high scoring ceiling for this game as a whole gives Zeke a clear shot at a multi-touchdown game. His ceiling remains intact in this spot, and his pass game involvement should keep him from landing a dud, even if Seattle is able to slow him down on the ground this week. The Buccaneers at the Broncos. Kickoff Sunday, September 27th at 4:25 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 43. Game Overview. The Bucs can win this game by taking a lead and allowing the Broncos to make mistakes, and it won't be surprising if that's their plan. The Broncos' best path to victory is to capitalize on a Bucs mistake or two and to keep this game low scoring. It's hard to see the Bucs failing, but it's also hard to see them scoring a ton of points. Similarly, it's hard to see the Broncos getting dominated, but it's hard to see them lighting up the scoreboard without some significant help. All things considered, this is not a spot that I'm particularly attracted to, but there are some price-considered pieces on the Broncos, and there are a couple of always-in-play options on Tampa Bay. How Tampa Bay will try to win. Given his reputation as possibly the greatest quarterback in NFL history, it's easy to mistake Tom Brady for a natural point producer. Of course, Brady can